This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by ChristianAudio.com. Listeners of the Gospel Coalition podcast can get Rosaria Butterfield's Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert audiobook download for free from Christian Audio. Add the audiobook to your cart at www.christianaudio.com and use the discount code TGC2016 at checkout. This offer is good through July 31, 2016. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. Today's podcast is a conversation with three black pastors. Jason Cook is a pastor at Fellowship Memphis and an editor for the Gospel Coalition. John Onwuchekwa is pastor of Cornerstone Church in Atlanta and a TGC Council associate. And James Robertson is lead pastor of Bridge Church in Brooklyn. They talk about difficult questions that intersect the Black Lives Matter discussions, such as black-on-black crime, mass incarceration of black males, and how to respond pastorally to those who have personally experienced injustice.
So, fellas, one of the most common arguments that I hear today, that many believers hear today in response to recent racial unrest in our country, is the black-on-black crime argument. That goes something along the lines of, well, why should black lives matter if black lives don't even matter to black people? In 2013, the FBI put out their end of the year stats, and it showed that African Americans commit five times more crime per capita than any other domestic group. And so, as pastors in urban contexts, what are we to do with this argument? What are we to do with the truth of black on black crime? How is the church supposed to interpret and handle this black on black crime argument?
I'll just start off. I mean, the very first thing is statistics tend to say what you want them to say. You know, 100% of people that use statistics usually use them to present a case or an agenda that they already have in mind. So, one, you know, we don't put our hope in just statistics. Like, one, we have to dig deeper and find out most of the people that commit these violent or heinous crimes against somebody else, oftentimes, I mean, there's more similarities in between race than we would like to see. So, you know, it's not like black people kill black people at a rate that white people don't kill white people at. Like, people tend to kill people based on proximity, and we still live in a world that is very much segregated, and so that really doesn't say anything. I think when you bring up a statistic like that, I think the biggest thing that it proves, it's an example of what deflection is, right? So it's a, hey, that is a problem. We do want to sit and talk about that. We just don't want to talk about that right now, because if we start to talk about that right now, it completely takes us off what we originally started to talk through. So the very first thing that I would say is, let's stay on topic first and address the first concern that was brought up.
Yeah, I mean, I would completely agree. I think the thing that frustrates me, I think when I hear black on black crime being brought up, as John said, as a deflection to Black Lives Matter, is the phrase or the terminology black on black crime was invented by black people. So it wasn't as if Fox News made the observation that over, you know, that there's that I think over 50% of the homicides that happen are African Americans. I mean, I could understand that happen, but I think the other thing is that when you look at, you know, as we do with the scriptures, when we look at a term or a phrase or a word, we have to look at it in context, right? So when we look at black on black crime in context, you know, it's birthed out of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and this is the NAACP using it, and Jesse Jackson using it, and even I remember it being in rap songs. Tupac used it, and we had a song called Self-Destruction at the end of the 80s, and he said black on black crime was way before our time. There were things that we were saying, but we were talking about our pain that black on black crime was bringing about in our hearts. We were using black on black crime as a means of talking about compassion. We were not using black on black crime as a means of deflection. And so what I get frustrated about in the conversation, and let's be honest, black on black crime, or crime that happens in the black community, as John said, proxemics murder, that is a major problem in the black community. Now, here's the question. Do you care? Do you honestly care about that issue to the point that you would want to bleed with me, walk with me, picket with me? Because there's a whole other side of this conversation that we could go into. And the question we could ask ourselves is, why are black-on-black murders never covered in the media like white-on-black murders? I mean, again, the terminology. Think about the terminology. Why did we use the word black on black crime? Because all the other crimes before were white on black crime. Systematically, it was white on black. And so we brought that about to say, hey, we're killing ourselves as opposed to being killed by white people, which we were used to. So I think it is really important that we realize that the minute you bring up pain or hurt that's happening in a community, I think the next step for us is not to identify, right? The gospel is not about identifying sin. It's about reconciling it. It's about dying for it. It's about sacrificing for it, which is what Christ does for us. And I think our job as believers, evangelicals, Christians, is for us to then sacrifice for the injustices that we see happening in community, whether a white life is tied to a black death or a black life is tied to a black death. We should feel more compassion. And if we don't feel like black, if you really don't feel like black people are talking about it enough, wouldn't that mean you would want to step in and talk about it some, as opposed to waiting on black people to care? I think that's an odd way of looking at compassion. I'll wait till you care, and then I'll care. I think that's an odd way. And again, the terminology is built out of black folks talking in the first place. So
And if black on black crime is only brought up as a rebuttal, then it's not like it's brought up out of a place that doesn't really seek to identify with the pain or lend some compassion. It's really brought up as a way to alleviate us from being able to feel guilt or compassion that we should feel for an issue. But it says, like James says, well, until you feel this way, then let's not talk about this. And I think to silence people in their pain because of another unrelated issue is something that's seems cold at best. I think cold is the only word that I can use for it.
And I think like any issue, John, you know, when you aren't close to a community, then you have to rate the problems in the community based upon what's being advertised to you. So think of yourself, if you go to a white evangelical church, everyone in your community is white, you hear about these statistics about the high percentage of homicides, and then you hear rap music, you hear murder and rap songs, and you see, you know, you go to World Star Hip Hop, then what you could presume is that black people promote violence and are violent, right? And instead of asking the question or actually assuming maybe the music and maybe this percentage is a byproduct of a deeper problem and not the problem itself. We don't want to presume that black folks are inherently violent. It could be, and I think that if you were to Google the term black-on-black crime, you would see on one end very, very conservative websites, and you see very, very liberal websites. The conservative websites are touting the stats, but the liberal websites, unfortunately, are the ones that are looking at they're like excavating the deeper problem. They're looking at mass incarceration, which I know we're going to touch on, but they're looking at underfunded educational pathways. They're also looking at the poor education and how it is a pipeline into the prison system. In addition to that, the breakdown of the family. And so you're looking at a systemically fractured community that somehow, and this is a whole other conversation, but somehow we have to get to the place that we have to talk about 1619 to 1968 and ask ourselves, after 1968, do we presume that the black community was just supposed to rocket ship up and without the help of any other people, in particular the white evangelical church, how they were able to step in and come alongside of us in that moment. And I think that's a conversation we need to have at some point, because one of the tragedies that we have in the church, and I'm someone who has benefited from mostly white seminaries and things of that nature, but I can be invited to a myriad of conversations about racial reconciliation, but rarely do we talk about racial injustice. You know, rarely do we talk about systemic racial injustice. Rarely do we talk about the past and how the past is affecting today. And if we can't talk about that, then I think we really can't have compassion about what we see happening in the community.
Yeah, that's good, man. I when I think about this issue, you know, I really like something, John, that you said. You said you talked about stats telling the story essentially of those commissioning those stats to be generated. And really, stats are an enterprise in convenience. And really, stats don't tell the whole story. So when I consider the situation of African Americans in America, the United States was founded in 1776 on July 4th. And this past July 4th, we celebrated 240 years of national independence. Well, when you consider the first slaves were brought into America 9 years after Jamestown was founded, African-Americans have essentially been subjugated the entire history of America up until, and James, you point out rightly, 1968, when the last black code was repealed. So essentially, black people in America have been theoretically living from underneath systemic oppression and state-sanctioned violence against minorities. Yes. And so when I consider black-on-black crime, I agree wholeheartedly with everything you guys are saying. But there's also a sociological element here. And I think understanding history and understanding sociology is important. The problem, though, is that humans are great at crafting general opinions out of stereotypes. And the media only exacerbates this. So that whenever we get issues like Alton Sterling and Philando Castile and Trayvon Martin and all these other issues, I think people immediately click into the stereotype of what they understand blackness to be, which is violent, miseducated, poor, and a whole litany of other stereotypes. And so my question would be to you men working in urban context, as you're actually dealing with real people, not stereotypes, real men and women, real people. How does this argument, how does black on black crime play a role in your ministries?
I know for me, you know, we first started having these conversations around, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and the issue of police brutality created for us a conversation with our folks at our church. And a good portion of our people, to be honest, are either college educated or in college or on their way to college. And so when you look at our church, most of our church has not committed a violent crime. And yet, right. when you begin a discussion with our people, you begin to see the context that they come from. You begin to right. see the fears that some of them have in the community. And we have a good portion of our folks that really don't want to talk about police brutality. They want to talk about violence in the community, and they want to have that deeper discussion. It's alarming when you talk to some of the women and you hear some of the ways that they've been treated by men. It's alarming when you hear about fathers that were never there because they're incarcerated. And it's alarming when you have such a high rate of single parent moms. All of this stemming from, much of it, black men out of work or underworked and now going into a pathway of drugs and then eventually incarceration. So we're not touching the individual as much as we're touching their family members. And the reality of that creates tremendous father wounds, fractured families, and a need to disciple these folks in ways where they just weren't able to have a context. And then starting to preach to them hope about things getting better. That is actually why we're starting another campus downtown, or rather in Flatbush, because our downtown campus is kind of in vogue. You know, we're by the Barclay Center, we're by all these different shops, but that won't be the case in Flatbush. And I think a lot of our people are excited about that, but they're also wondering how it's going to be different. And so a lot of that is going to be a journey and a learning process for us.
Yeah. I mean, so a whole lot of along the lines of what James said, I mean, you look at the majority of our church, the majority of our church is African American. But what takes place is, I mean, like James said, you know, the types that are at our church kind of in year one that have moved into the West End and their hope has been to pour and to invest into a community like that, or folks that have been to college, well educated, have good jobs. And so what we're trying to do right now is we're really trying to take the long-term approach to all of this. So what we found out is that, man, the best impact that we can have, it starts with kids, right? So starts mm-hmm. with the kids that are 10 years old to 13 years old. I mean, it was Frederick Douglass that said, it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And so that's what we've seen. I mean, we've planted roots there in the West End, and our prayer is that the acorn of what we plant will turn into an oak tree years from now. And so there's just small, tangible things that we're starting to get our church on, from mentoring. We partnered with a group to start a bike shop on the back of our church where we can bring in the kids from West End that have nothing to do, teach them how to fix bikes. And as they come in there, they work and they earn bikes. And as they work and put hours in a shop trying to learn how to build a bike from scratch, they get a free bike at the end. And then they can do it again and get another free bike and then pass it on to their friend. And so all the while, that just serves as a chance for us not just to build in them this concept of work, but to share the gospel and to talk about what God has done and what takes place. I mean, we're 12 months into this bike shop, and we may have 20 kids that come each week. So it's, you know, lots of hard work, lots of time that's kind of put in, but it's not like this mass change or these huge numbers of people that are going to come in. But it's, by God's grace, 10 young dudes that we've grabbed right now that we hope in 15 years will be good fathers. And it's kind of this slow work that really doesn't make any news, that really doesn't combat any objections that folks have. But it's like, hey, there's lots of stuff that needs to be done on a mass scale, and we do want to work to do those things, but we don't want to forsake kind of this present ordinary work that we can do right now. So right now as a church, we're just trying to give ourselves to the present ordinary small things that we hope will yield much fruit many years from now, but may not bring about huge change in the short term.
Yeah, that's really good. You both men touched on something that I think is worth exploring, and that is the mass incarceration of African-American men. James, you talked about that being a plight pastorally as something that you handle and deal with in your current context. John, you mentioned the same things, and I really like that Frederick Douglass quote. It's easier to fix or train kids than it is to repair broken men.
Yeah,
and in Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow, she lays out kind of the foundation for thinking through current systemic issues and current systemic injustices leading back to the brokenness of the family, which many of our Anglo brothers and sisters would say it starts with the family. The breakdown of the family is the breakdown of culture. But there's also evidence to suggest that mass incarceration of African-American men being perceived as a threat has led to this. One small example is the prosecution rates and time given to offenders caught in possession repeatedly with cocaine versus crack cocaine. Crack cocaine is typically convicted at 3 to 5 times higher than your regular white collar cocaine. So, so this issue of mass incarceration, is Michelle Alexander making too much of this, or is she right on the head with this?
Yeah, I don't think she's making too much of it. Like those things that you just brought up about the, the prosecution rates for crack cocaine up against cocaine. And it's like, I just sit back and it's like as stuff like that comes out, how is that not seen, or how is that not viewed as discriminatory? It just, it baffles me to look at, or just to, man, I mean, so if you just take some time and just go back of a few more steps. And I know, it's been said time and time again, like, where did they come from? Like, how did the drugs even get into the, like, we don't own boats, right? Like, where does, right? Like, that's what I'm saying. And so it's those things that I feel like, oh, listen, like those are legitimate questions. Like, if we are going to talk about this, let's talk about all of the questions, and let's not just like segment it and talk about the questions that seem to indict a particular group. Let's talk about it all, like, to this day. And maybe one of y'all can help me out. I don't know if I have heard a legitimate answer for the differentiation between sentences with those who have crack cocaine and just cocaine. Have any of y'all heard anything that would legitimize, like, such a wide gap in between those?
Well, my understanding is that it was really birthed out of the 1994 crime bill that really the Clintons, Bill Clinton was in full support of. But I think what's interesting is that black folks were in support of it too. At the time it was, interestingly enough, from what I remember, it was a response to violent crime. And it was a way to place a hyper focus on, some of this we have to be honest with, right? Where the places that cocaine was being sold was not accompanied by as much violence. Where crack was being sold, so there was more violence. So the idea was then place more emphasis on the crack cocaine dealer. And so there was some pure strain in it. And again, black pastors, black leaders were all in full support of that crime bill. But what I find interesting is that do I think that that is a do I think the difference between the two is a portion of the problem? I do, but I also think we have a prison industrial complex that Michelle touches on as well, in that there are prisons that are making a profit off having prisoners, which intrinsically does not give you a pure motivation to rehabilitate. I think in addition to that, you know, when you look at putting prisoners, you know, in jail, at the end of the day, there just seems to be, whether it's drugs or whether it's another issue, there seems to be a problem in the same way that slavery was, that black communities are targeted more, policed more, and so you have more interactions at the end of the day. But that's my understanding, John, of that issue with that.
Yeah, got it. Crime. Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with mass incarceration, I'm thinking back through history at cases, you know, where African American men have been unjustly prosecuted for crimes they did not commit, or prosecuted at a more severe rate than their white or non-African American counterparts. Is this stuff still happening today? Is mass incarceration, is this still a thing, or is mass incarceration just a byproduct of pre-civil rights world and post-civil rights? These things are no longer issues.
Well, you know, I don't know the numbers, Jason, so I don't know them off the top, but I think the sticking point, I mean, I would venture to say that being that the Black Lives Matter, the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, the essence of it is not built in scriptures. I would say the Bible of the Black Lives Matter movement is Michelle Alexander's book. That's kind of their working lingo. In addition to that, there seems to be, we see video after video, right? And it links to, so I don't know the numbers as well to, when I say mass, what am I saying numerically? But right. I can tell you culturally that all of us feel that no matter the rate of education I get, the how much education I get, no matter how much income I make, I feel like I could still end up going to prison at some point in my life. And if I feel that with a master's degree, how much more do I feel that if I'm in poverty? So I think that's a culture we have of sensing that incarceration could be a part of my life. And then when I look at the rest of my family, I'm not far too separated from being in jail myself.
You know what's interesting about that is, growing up, I always had this fear. I grew up in the deep, deep South, in Birmingham, Alabama. And I grew up with this fear that I was going to spend my life in prison for a crime that I did not commit. And I remember being a kid and thinking to myself that I could be caught in the wrong place at the wrong time and not be guilty of anything, but because of the color of my skin, that I would be unjustly prosecuted to the point where I would spend the rest of my life looking at a prison cell wall. And I'm just wondering, you know, as you say that, James, I immediately think about being 8 years old and praying to the Lord Jesus that I would never be in a position where I would be unjustly convicted, because if I were, I knew the world wasn't friendly toward men who looked like me. And so as I begin to think about those issues, especially for mothers who are raising young black kids and even black men themselves after Baton Rouge and Dallas and New York and Chicago and Cleveland and on and on and on, there's this fear for young black men, and there's this fear that they could be in the wrong place at the wrong time and ultimately suffer for something that is that doesn't merit their life being taken from it. And so I'm curious, as pastors, how do you pastorally handle that fear? Yeah. You know, given the assumed assumption that we have a biblical worldview. But also, what kind of instruction and training are we giving to young Black men, to mothers, to people in the Black community who may have a similar way of thinking?
That's good. Yeah. Can I just give a little kind of disclaimer before we start this off? Not primarily for African-American pastors, but for our Anglo pastors that may kind of hear this. And So last week, I get an email from a guy that I don't really know. And I do believe that he has the best of intentions. But in the email, as he talks through kind of all of what goes on, and I think he heard me share some of the same sentiments that both of y'all have shared, just about this fear of, like, that there is kind of this real fear of the police at times. His challenge to me was this. He said, "Now, John, you know, I heard you say that," and he said, "Man, brother, I don't want you to buy into the recent created racial tension and this fear of the police that has been forced on African Americans by the media." So it's just a caution. And I cautioned him, and I was just like, "Brother, I'm an African American that grew up in the suburbs of Houston, Texas, and 99% of the African Americans that I know and that I talk to have some story of impropriety that's been done to them by the police. That, like, us, it's not made up. This was before social media, where we saw videos and all this stuff. This was in a world that was much less global. But regardless of where I went, I found brothers with the same story." And so for all of the Anglo past, as we go and sit or whatever and talk through this, I just really want you to know there is nothing recent. There is nothing fabricated. There is nothing created. There is nothing imposed. I think this is not somebody that's never seen a plane crash that says, "I'm scared to get on a plane because I think it's going to crash," right? This is somebody with legitimate cause for concern and just not knowing. So, I just want to throw that out before y'all jump in.
Well, let me say this, John, to your point, as you kind of alluded to the fact that we may have an audience that is wondering how to counsel in this situation. Let me just say that. I'll be honest, man. When this all first started coming about, I found myself almost, not to use this negatively, but almost like towing the evangelical party line. Like, "Well, first, guys, we pray for all men in government, and the police are, they have the sword." And I'm just throwing, verses out there to make sure that we honor. And then what I realized was, it was if I was talking to a wife who felt abused by a husband, and all I was saying was submit.
Wow.
I was throwing verbiage out there, but I wasn't listening. And so I felt, well, I'm Black and I've been through this, so let me just kind of redirect you to the truth. And as these things kept happening, I was like, why am I treating this different than any other counseling situation? Be quiet. Listen. And just let them talk through their pain. Yes.
Right.
Yes, we're going to bring it back to the gospel. Yes, we're going to talk about how God is working things all together. Amen. But I may not get to it in that first conversation.
That's right.
Absolutely. That's so good.
And what will be dynamic is I will see how radical the pain is. There's one girl in our church. She began to talk one night about her brother who was in jail. And, you know, and again, I'm like, well, what did he do? That's the first thing that went through my head. I'm like, well, what did he do? But then she talked about, she said, no, but, you know, he used to sell drugs. And she said, but James, they busted down my door. My brother had food in his hand. He had his hand up. He was not a violent man. He did wrong things, yes, but he wasn't violent. And then she starts crying, and she starts talking about how, she said, James, I couldn't recognize him that night. They beat him so bad that when we went to the jail, we couldn't even recognize him. And she's just soaked in her tears, and she's crying. And I just said to myself, you know, there could be a chance that this young man made a bad mistake, which white people and black people make bad mistakes, but he was treated as if he was one of the most violent criminals in the world, and he was treated right. as a thug, and, you know, and perception and imagination legislated the moment more than the situation itself, and he got beat up, basically. And, you know, we talked, yeah. and then I heard one story after another, and what happened is my heart began to grow for the situation. Mm. And so when I began to talk about the government, when I began to talk about the gospel, it came coated in a package of love and understanding and patience. And so my counseling, I had to grow in my counseling of this situation like anyone would. So if I have to do that as an African American, how much more would anyone have to do this if you are not right. close to that situation?
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, I mean, to your point, like, part of it is doing the work and really pinpointing, like, all right, like, all right, what is the fear? I think sometimes the blanket statement is thrown, right, scared of the police. And I talked to a white brother that was like, man, you know, it just never crossed my mind. Like, I teach my daughters, if you're ever in any kind of trouble at all, the very first thing that you do is you call 911. Like, that was the goal. And so he's like, it never even crossed my mind that there would be people that come into things with a distrust of the police that I don't have or that I don't share. And so when we kind of talk about this, like, fear of the police, like, do I think that all cops are bad? Absolutely not. Do I feel that there are good cops? Yes, I know plenty of them. The concern or the fear that, like me as a black man in America, the concern that I have is this. It's not that there's just good cops and bad cops. My concern is that I don't know if there are structures in place that would deter the bad cops from doing the worst things on a bad day, right? Mm. So it's not that I'm scared that every time that I get stopped that I'm going to be harassed. It's just, man, you know, you look over the course of these past few years and you just start to think through, all right, not even the convictions, but just the indictments. Like, let's just get to a trial, and it just seems like we all say that there's good cops and there's bad cops, but in some of the most high-profile cases, I think the sentiment that pervades, or the reason why, when stuff like this comes up, that there's just this kind of angst and this despair, is because it just feels like, here we go again. It's not just that somebody did wrong, but it's that there's nothing that seems like it would stop the wrongdoers from feeling the freedom to do wrong and to feel as if they get off the hook. So I think that's the big fear, the checks and balances that just leaves you at sometimes feeling like you could be at the mercy of a bad cop on a bad day, which I do feel like is a legitimate fear.
And I think as a kid growing up and feeling that, I think the most emasculating feeling was the feeling of impotence. that if I did get caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, that I had zero power to appeal to a higher court or a higher authority to get myself out of that situation, because I felt at the time, and I know this is how many of my African-American friends feel, is that there is no proper recourse or just court of appeals for those who are caught in such unfortunate or misfortunate situations, which leads to, if you feel impotent, just kind of psychologically getting into the mind of much of my family, if you feel impotent in a situation, you will do that which makes you feel powerful. And a lot of times that looks like acting out. Sometimes that looks like being a ladder climber in a company to gain power and status. But as I interrogate the Bible and as I look at Jesus, he's a man who says that in order to be powerful, you've got to be powerless first. In order to be made much, you've got to become less. And there's that this really alternative worldview here. And so, you know, when I consider the impotence of the Black man in the face of law enforcement, I do think in some small measure that has much to do with the creation of and really kind of the vitriolic response toward law enforcement by those belonging to left wing movements, not including Black Lives Matter and Nation of Islam and Hebrew Israelites and so on and so forth.
Right.
Fellas, I want to finish our time by talking through, and I want to ask you guys, you know, the Republican National Convention is happening right now, and I think many of us have seen the viral prayer and the viral invocation of one African-American pastor that we all have our opinions about. But what I'm interested to get your thoughts on are Representative Steve King, his comments, the representative from Iowa, his comments regarding the lack of social and cultural input by subcultures. And to be fair, he actually cites the footprint of Christianity as setting up the world of this being a Western ideal, of this being a Western endeavor. And he says that no other subgroup or subculture has done as much for the betterment of the world than essentially the Western world, which we can perceive as the Anglo world. Fellas, what are we to do with this?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, you know, he's only saying what people think. I mean,
right.
He is just boldly ignorant, but at least he's bold with it. I just think, man, I unfortunately think that this country, we have a difficult time talking about race because we have a very difficult time understanding our racialized past. Let's quickly just reference the moment that Lecrae just completely obliterated Twitter on 4th of July by posting people picking cotton on, you know, 4th of July versus celebrating, right? And what he was saying was, as I look back on history, this is what happened to me. Even when I look in New York, I mean, the city of New York was first, you know, founded by the Dutch. And then once the Dutch got here, they got the land of Manhattan from the Native Americans for like $300. And then the Native Americans, they then tried to place a tax on the Native Americans. The Native Americans, like anybody, said, you can't place a tax on me in my home.
Right.
And because they would not pay the tax, a guy named Peter Stuyvesant then issued the murder of those Indians, putting them, slaughtering them, hundreds of Native Americans. And then from that moment, they went into selling beaver skins. And from beaver skins, they went into selling slaves. So when I look back at our history, I look at tyranny, I look at an ambush. Mm-hmm. For others, they look at hard work. They look at immigration. And so, I have a tough time hearing this. But again, I think he is just being more honest about what people actually believe.
Yeah, Jason. Yeah. And I think just to tag on to that, so I think when he tried to clean it up and talk about Christianity, I think dug himself a bigger ditch. And I do think that in some way he placed this indictment on this brand of conservative evangelicalism, whereas like what he said is in a number of schools how church history is taught. So it wasn't until like I went outside of some of the book lists that I had in school as we were going through church history and starting to learn about the pivotal ways in which Christianity was advanced and where it bore much fruit. It wasn't until I went outside of some of the book lists before I realized, wait a minute, more black people than St. Augustine had an impact in the advancement of Christianity. And so I do think that this should be just kind of a charge to us to remember, let's change the way that we talk about the impact of Christianity in the world, and let's not relegate church history to what went on in Western Europe and the West, but there are five other continents where Christianity was at work.
Go ahead. I was going to say briefly, I remember I'm a continuationist, and I remember being in seminary, and the statement was, will tongues cease around the world? And I asked myself, how do you know? Like, what historian, how did you get all this data? And I was like, maybe tongues ceased in your world, but I'm not sure it ceased around the globe. And, again, it's that old phrase, history is his story. And, we have to be careful about that.
And just one final observation. I find it interesting that his worldview colors that statement in the sense that he, along with a lot of my other brothers and sisters, tend to import race onto the biblical text. And so we tend to think about our Savior. We tend to think about the apostles. We tend to think about Paul and the other gospel writers and associate them with our own race. And so I think in the moment, I don't think he really thought he was saying anything that was untrue, because perhaps Jesus is a white man. Just a thought there. I know my grandmother had a picture of black Jesus hanging up in her house. And so I thought Jesus was a black man. And so nonetheless, fellas, thank you so much for your time today. I'm so grateful to be here. Joined by John O. from Cornerstone Church, Atlanta, and James Roberson at Bridge Church, New York. Thanks, fellas.
Hey, thanks, Jason.
I bless you, man.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.